Welcome to Cleaning Up Utah's Air, a town hall meeting focused on pollution solutions, sponsored by the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW Public Radio. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. I'll be hosting tonight's event. No one likes Utah's seasonal inversions, when pollution from restaurants and vehicles, fireplaces and dry cleaners, mines and refineries gets trapped in the valleys for days, sometimes weeks at a time. It looks bad, it smells bad, and breathing it poses real health risks. While our topography presents real challenges to clearing the air, there are ways to reduce and prevent pollution from building up, and tonight's forum is dedicated to exploring those ideas and to finding answers to your questions. Over the past month, many dozens of you have shared your bad air day stories with us at sltrib.com, and you posed some pretty tough questions as well. So tonight we've lined up a distinguished panel of guests to try and get you some answers. And joining me this evening is Carrie Kelly, an engineer and research associate at the Institute for Clean and Secure Energy at the University of Utah. Sean Tigan is senior research analyst at Utah Foundation, a nonpartisan public policy think tank based in Salt Lake City. Bryce Bird is also with us, executive director of the Utah Division of Air Quality, and Dr. Denitsa Blagev is a pulmonologist who specializes in asthma at the Schmidt Chest Clinic at Intermountain Medical Center. Please join me in welcoming our distinguished panel tonight. We're broadcasting live from the City Library in downtown Salt Lake City. We're live video streaming at sltrib.com. We're broadcasting on KCPW 88.3 and 105.3 FM and at kcpw.org. And as I mentioned, we're taking your questions. If you're here in the auditorium, raise your hand when it's time for your questions. We'll get to that in just a few minutes. You can also send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+, or you can go to the comments section of our page at sltrib.com. You can also send email, utairquality@sltrib.com. And again, we're going to try to get to as many questions as we can during this hour. Carrie Kelly, I want to start with you.
Okay.
From a scientist's perspective, you're a chemical engineer. What do we know about the air that we breathe, and what don't we know?
So can I ask for a clarification? So you mean where our pollution comes from, or what do we know about what causes inversions?
Let's talk about where pollution comes from.
Okay. So we know that about 12% of our pollution comes from point sources. About 30% comes from area sources. Those are things like home heating and wood burning and print and graphics operations. And then the remaining 60-some percent comes from transportation. So that includes on-road and off-road mobile sources.
What is this PM2.5 that we keep hearing about? Describe it for us.
So PM2.5 is particulate matter that's finer than 2.5 microns in diameter. And that's really important because that passes easily into your lung, where it can have health effects.
Okay, well, let's go straight there. Dr. Blagev, what does breathing PM2.5 filled air mean for us, mean for our bodies, for our health?
So there are quite a few health effects related to breathing pollution, and there are large and multiple studies linking increased air pollution to a variety of important long-term and short-term effects. Long-term, we know that people that live and are exposed to areas of higher air pollution have increased risk of dying younger, having more heart disease, heart attacks, heart failure, lung cancer, COPD, emphysema, developing asthma. Short term, we know that on days where the air pollution counts are higher, people are more likely to be hospitalized for flares or exacerbations of these things. So heart attacks or asthma or COPD exacerbations. Specifically with the particulates, we're learning more about what it is exactly about them that leads to all these far-reaching effects. One of the mechanisms that we think is at play is that these small particles are a really good size for getting exactly and very efficiently into the lungs. So our mouths and noses are designed to filter out, and so some of the bigger particles may get trapped in our nose, but then the small ones are really great at getting deep into the lungs and going into the vasculature, so in the blood vessels. And there's some evidence that these then in turn can activate platelets, which are the blood clotting cells in the blood. And that's one potential mechanism for the increased risk of heart attacks and heart failure, which you might not think is obvious. Perhaps the lung effects seem more obvious, but the heart ones don't. And there's a variety of other studies on, linking increased risk of autism and neonatal effects as well. So I think we're still learning exactly what it is about pollution and which particulates and gases are causing which effects, but what's been clear is that there are effects and they're not hard to find. Mm.
Sean Tigan, your research notes that air pollution has become a leading issue that Utahns care about. We found that in our Salt Lake Tribune poll as well. Your research also shows that over the past 15 years, not much has changed when it comes to bad air days. So maybe you can just give us some highlights. What are a few other highlights of your study?
You know, I guess that is one of the highlights. When you look at the amount of pollution that's coming out of these point sources and area sources and out of our vehicles and whatnot, there is less pollution that we estimate, and these are some pretty good estimates that are coming out of these different places. But when you analyze the number of bad air days, particularly looking at winter inversion, this PM2.5 bad air days, we found that you know, those levels haven't really decreased all that well. But I guess a couple of the other big things we found, just is that there's a pretty big difference between what people think causes bad air and what are really probably more likely the percentages of the bad air that Carrie Kelly was speaking about. We also found that you know, there are a lot of different things going on. A lot of people are really taking a lot of different kinds of actions. There are tons of organizations, both here locally and nationally and in different other communities across the United States, that are really working on this issue and are really, I think, tackling it from a bunch of different ways. And I think ultimately what we found is that taking a really getting a handle on this issue and making sure if we really want to pursue having cleaner air, having fewer bad air days, it is going to take a concerted effort. It isn't just, you know, we can't just blame one person. You can't just blame, if you're a biker, you can't just say, oh, it's those cars, even though sometimes I'm prone to do that because I'm a biker myself. But if you're somebody that's looking out across the horizon and you see smoke coming out of some smokestacks, you can't just blame those smokestacks either from those big industrial sources. It's going to take a little bit of work from everybody in order to really get a handle on the situation.
Bryce Byrd, just a few minutes ago during his State of the State address, Governor Herbert unveiled some additional measures to combat air pollution, including accelerating the Tier 3 fuel standards, limiting wood burning during the inversion season, replacing old buses and cars that pollute in the state's fleets. Briefly, give us a little more meat on those bones of those proposals and other ways that the state of Utah is responding to our air pollution problem.
Sure, and I really have to start that answer with a quick history lesson as well. You know, I think that it's clear to everyone that we've always had air pollution problems here in the Salt Lake Valley. That has been addressed many times in the past through our past state planning efforts, and now we're going through that process again. And so every time we find a new strategy that really is technically founded, and I will mention, even though she wasn't mentioned by name, Carrie Kelly's research was mentioned in the governor's State of the State address tonight. So as we learn more about our particular air pollution, we have been able to identify strategies that are quantifiable, enforceable, and permanent in order to address that. And we're just in that process right now. As you mentioned, one of the things that we learned as part of this effort is the fact that vehicles can be operated in a cleaner fashion. And one of the keys to that is the fuel that goes into those vehicles. Over the past 30 years, really, we've seen a number of improvements to the gasoline that actually helps the vehicle run better and have lower emissions. The latest iteration of that was part of the Tier 2 federal standards, which required the refineries to produce motor fuels that were at 30 parts per million of sulfur. And with the proposed Tier 3 standards, that drops down to 10. What that does is allows the pollution controls on the vehicle to operate more efficiently. And so every vehicle in the valley would operate cleaner with cleaner fuels. And that's really what the push is right now, to make sure that we get those in our area as quickly as possible.
Hmm. You're listening to Cleaning Up Utah's Air, a town hall meeting sponsored by the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, broadcasting live from the City Library in downtown Salt Lake City. If you want to know something about air pollution or have an idea on how government or technology or individuals can improve the air that we breathe, send it along to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. Put it in the comments section of our town hall story at sltrib.com. And for those here in our live audience, get ready. You're almost up. Again, our panel includes Carrie Kelly with the Institute for Clean and Secure Energy at the University of Utah, Bryce Bird, Executive Director of the Utah Division of Air Quality, pulmonologist Denitsa Blagov with Intermountain Medical Center, and Sean Tigan with Utah Foundation. I want to get to a few of our questions that came in on email over the past weeks. This is from, Doug and Margaret. What effect does elevation have on air quality? Do people living on the benches have less pollution than those living on the valley floor? Carrie, do you want to try that?
Sure. We actually did a study about 2 years ago with a little bit of some borrowed monitors from the Division of Air Quality and some students at the University of Utah, and we looked at the difference between particle concentrations during inversions with altitude in the avenues, and we did find that people who are, once you're higher up, you get in the inversion later and you get out of it earlier, and also the inversion tends to slosh around a little bit during the day, so you do get these kind of clean air intrusions even if you're sort of in the inversion. So generally you're better off living higher in the benches. However, when people ask me if they should move out of the valley and drive to the valley for work, one of the challenges is that one of the big contributors to air pollution is transportation, so I don't want to encourage people to move out of the valley and drive into the valley to work.
All right. Anyone else want to jump in there? Okay. Let's go to a health question. And this is from Tiffany Starbuck. She has a couple. Dr. Blagov, get ready. Do the chemicals stay in my hair and do they stay on my pillow when I get up? If the chemicals are on my coat when I go inside, do they stay on my coat or do they shake off onto other things in the house? If I eat an apple outside, do the chemicals in the air land on the apple and I ingest it? Perhaps you can shed some light on this.
So I think one of the areas where we know that what we're calling, I guess, third-hand smoke is where there is research on chemicals on clothes and containing carcinogens would be with tobacco smoke. So if you smoke or if you're in a room with someone who smokes, and then if you walk out of that room and you're no longer breathing the smoke, there is an effect from, those carcinogens are there. I'm not aware of studies related to air pollution, but I will say that eating an apple that has PM2.5s, I don't think is gonna be necessarily the issue. I think the issue is breathing in the particles and activating kind of the inflammatory response. And in terms of some of the pollution that's related to gases, then those are in the air and shouldn't be, you walk out of that room, it should be fine.
Okay, Bryce?
Just to add to that, one of the things that we learned as part of the research leading to this plan was the components of our air pollution differ from many areas of the country, and that is we're dominated by the secondary formation of, in particular, one component, and that's ammonium nitrate. I think some people saw some recent news articles from a professor at Utah State University, Dr. Randy Martin, who really looked at indoor versus outdoor concentrations and found that really the purpose of that work was to justify or add support to the fact that we ask people to remain indoors if they're being impacted. We ask them to exercise indoors rather than outdoors. And in fact, there is a great level of protection indoors versus outdoors. Part of that is the particles that make up our pollution. The ammonium nitrate begins to disassociate once it gets warm. And so that's really the same reason why we don't have high pollution year-round in our valleys. We really need that lid on, we need the high humidity, and that inversion scenario in order for us to form the particles, not only trap them, but there is a level of protection indoors because those particles aren't robust and they don't stick around in our environment.
Hmm. I want to get to questions from our live audience here at the City Library. There will be some roving microphones going up and down, so if you'll raise your hand, state your name and your question clearly, and keep it to one question, that would be terrific. Right here.
Hello. Yes, I just want to address this to Bryce because he just brought up the ammonium nitrate, and you said that's unique to this valley as opposed to other parts of the country, and I'd like you to address What is that quality in that particle that is different, and where is it coming from?
That is an excellent question, and if you hang around afterwards, some of the posters as you came in really address that. Really, the backstory is, as we started the work to develop our air pollution plans, we first started with EPA's national estimates about emissions of PM2.5. And what we found is, as we ran the models that were available, they just didn't connect at all. In fact, we couldn't create enough air pollution in our models to demonstrate what we're finding on our filters here in our valleys. That led to a lot of research work, a lot of good head scratching, and what we found is that the particles are actually formed in the atmosphere. And again, the confirming information was work done at BYU. Dr. Jaron Hansen was instrumental in that. Looking at this secondary formation, it actually is limited, or the component of the emissions that we can control the best is with volatile organic compounds. And so the plans that we've developed have really focused on that. So if we can turn off the limiting factor of that, that turns off that component in our atmosphere. But again, it is unique to us. Our filters, when you analyze them, there are 70, and in some cases in Cache Valley, up to 90% this ammonium nitrate. And again, without this chemical formation, those particles wouldn't be in our atmosphere.
We're on the radio for a live broadcast, so I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut off a follow-up. You're not on the mic. Let's go to this one over here. Go ahead, sir. What's your name?
Hi, my name is Cash. Does pollution get here from other countries or states?
Okay, where does our pollution come from? Carrie, Sean, who wants to jump in on that one?
I'll take it. Well, during our inversions, most of the pollution comes from all the sources in our valley. During our inversions, we're not very affected by pollution from other states or other countries.
Some of the summertime issues with ozone, that can travel much farther, and that does come from other places. And there are some studies that have shown that comes all the way from Asia. It can make it all the way and travel all the way across the ocean and get here.
And Bryce, did you have something?
That's what I was going to say as well. And in fact, what we're seeing is, because of that transport, our annual concentrations are going up for ozone. Even though our peaks are coming down, we're seeing the annual concentrations going up. And we actually conducted a study in the West Desert looking at this, and we're seeing that in there as well. So it really does lead to this conclusion that it really is that we're getting transported Las Vegas, Los Angeles, and beyond.
This is a related question from Karen Longhurst on her email. Has outreach been done to seek input from other large cities worldwide which have faced air pollution problems? When we're looking at solutions, have we looked outside of the U.S.? How are other nations combating the pollution problem? Obviously, they've got it too. Anyone? Sean?
So you know, we do have somewhat of a unique situation here. And while it does help to look outside, and we get a lot of ideas from these different places, I think that every geography and every situation is pretty specific to kind of the area and what's going on. And Bryson, you might be able to kind of tackle this a little bit more, but it's at least a place to start looking outside of out of Utah and into other communities. But really, the action that we take here in along the Wasatch Front, it needs to be specific to this area, I would say.
So again, back to my backstory. Once we found out that these VOCs were important to us, the first thing we did is looked at other areas of the country that have addressed that. And what we found is there's 15 eastern states as part of the Ozone Transport Commission that really looked at controls of these volatile organic compounds, and then California. And so the first thing we did is looked at rules that were in place there. Just one of those rules that the Air Quality Board adopted recently came about through that pathway, and that was the Consumer Products Rule. Now, if you're not familiar with that rule, hopefully you won't notice any difference. It won't impact you at all. But there are cleaner, less emitting compounds that were already required in California and 15 eastern states. We worked with the manufacturers, adopted exactly the same standards here, and so they just sent those product lines to our area. They're still effective, they still work just as they did before, but they're up to 40% less emitting, and again, the consumer shouldn't know a difference at all.
There's a question in the middle here, and then we'll go to this side.
Hey guys, this question is mostly for Bryce. I'm Carl Ingwell, by the way. My question is, with the Tier 3 gasoline, if we're not going to try and do anything to move away from fossil fuels as a state, with the Tier 3 gasoline, I worry about a couple things. I worry about our doubling in population by 2040. I also worry about what's known as the Jevons paradox, which states that as a technology starts to clean up, people think, oh, well, it's cleaner, we can use it so much more, and we're just kind of right back to where we started from. This is a two-parter, so bear with me. So under the state implementation plan, we're relying mostly on federal auto emission standards to basically clean up our air, and we're letting industry increase 12%. So I worry a little bit about this Jevons paradox and the doubling of our population, as well as a 12% increase in industry. Maybe we won't make those standards by 2019 or even farther into the future. And last but not least, does the fact that industry is increasing 12% over the course of the SIP have anything to do with Steve Sands being the chair of the Air Quality Board?
There's a lot of inside baseball questioning going there. Bryce, break it down for us. First of all, what is Tier 3? Explain what that does. And then if you could address his concerns about people's behaviors and the population boom that is expected to come.
So first, maybe with your question about the cleaner fuels, maybe I shouldn't have told you about the cleaner consumer products. Still use less, okay? They're only 40% less emitting, so hopefully that won't bear out in that as well. As we talk about our future, I think for all of us, we need to be involved in future planning. As part of Envision Utah's next planning cycle, air quality is the number two issue, water being number one. And how we grow is so important. And really, we've seen a lot of the infrastructure backbone with UTA. So we have the lines running north and south. The next thing we need to do is use those lines, make sure we have transit-oriented development so there's options for people to use that to live even without a car. And then the next thing is that we need to focus our growth in jobs in the outlying areas as well. So that we don't have to drive 40 or 50 or 60 miles each day to go to and from work. And that's part of that growth strategy that's going to be developed out of that Envision Utah process. Second, thank you for the question. The state implementation plan is a process that's driven by EPA regulations. The first thing we do is develop inventories. The inventories are very transparent, and we don't discount or hide anything. The inventories grew from 2008 as we came out of the recession, and we had to keep that growth growing in all sectors. So industry, area sources, and mobile sources all grow throughout the planning cycle of the state implementation plan. Second thing is we had to true up any changes that happened between 2008 and the time the plan was developed. And so there's four companies in particular that obtained permits under the existing regulations before the SIP went into place. But with the Air Quality Board's action in December and then adopting the stationary source requirements in January, that puts that cap on that future growth. And what it does is then goes down from there. And so we account for all the growth that happened, but the SIP itself all is reductions. We identified meaningful reductions from every sector, and transportation alone would not solve the problem. It took all of it, and then even then, we're just barely able to show attainment.
Here's a related question from our email, Gary Mesker. Are Governor Herbert and the Division of Air Quality going to enact stricter pollution requirements than the EPA in order to reduce our pollution? And if not, why not? Sorry, Bryce, you're on the hot seat.
So clearly we have to meet the standard. That's the first step that we have, and that is a federal requirement, but it's also a public requirement as well. I think that even though we've made progress to this date, everyone in this room would agree that we certainly are not done yet, and we need to address our particular winter inversion situation. If I could answer an earlier question as well, is have we seen progress? Where we've been able to see great progress is the actual emissions reductions have led to the annual average for all the pollutants going down. And so for PM2.5 since 2002 to today, we've seen a 30% reduction in the annual average. And as was mentioned, that is the most important link to the health effects, is that annual average. Our current averages are below 10 micrograms per cubic meter in all of the areas of the state, and that is significant. That is nearly as clean as any area in the country, and we hope to get a little bit cleaner, but there's no really, that is a huge issue for us. The air is so clean the rest of the year that our annual average isn't an issue. Where we have challenges demonstrating progress is actually very hard to find, because it's hidden by the meteorology. If you remember 2012, if we took that year and said, let's measure our air quality progress, we would have been great. It was a fantastic year for air pollution. Not because the emissions changed that year, it was because the weather patterns were different that year. We had storms that were back to back, we didn't have any long inversions at all, but yet at the end of 2012 into 13, even though the emissions continued to go down, the meteorology switched. We had a large storm event, and then the storms missed us for 4 to 6 weeks, and so we saw inversion after inversion after inversion. That same pattern's in place right now. And so it's harder to see the progress, and that's when we look at other things, like how fast did we build in the inversion? Back in the 80s, we used to double the concentration of particulate matter on a daily basis. If you notice this last inversion that we had, it was 5 to 6 days into the inversion before we reached the standard. I think that is great progress that I think that we can justify and show that it is actually working.
Let's go up here. Yes.
Hi, Sean, this question's for you. My name is Josh Woodison. Is there any technology available to retrofit vehicles to reduce 2.5 particles?
You know, it's not widely available, it seems. I did a little research on this, and I don't believe anything made it into the final draft of my report, but you can get catalytic converters that are new and improved and retrofit them onto a vehicle. It's probably, you know, that's probably not the easiest or best way to tackle this problem. Probably the easiest or best way to tackle the problem of emissions from vehicles is to just not start it as much as often when it's cold. So the cold starts are a huge issue, and this is probably something that's probably been on the radio a little bit, and people probably know quite a bit about. But when you turn that ignition in the morning, you are emitting a possibly over 50% of all the emissions for in that first 2 minutes while your catalytic converter is getting up to temperature of your whole trip. And so if you do start your car less often, or start it more often in a compressed period during those bad air days, that's certainly beneficial. But it's also beneficial, you know, just reducing trips and doing things like that during bad air days. You know, only about 20% of our trips are to and from work. We do like recreational and social type of miles are about 30% of those trips. Shopping and errands are about 30% of those trips, and then you've got some religious and other kind of cultural things. But if you can just put off some of those items during the period when that stuff is sloshing around in the valley, and maybe instead of going to get a gallon of milk today, you know, I'll just wait and hold off for 2 days and go to the store and get all my stuff from the grocery store at once. Those are really the easiest and most cost-efficient ways of taking care of pollution, whereas putting a brand new catalytic converter on a vehicle is going to be out of the cost range for most people that are driving the cars that really need it, and those are those older vehicles. Because older vehicles do, as Bryce was saying, the vehicles have really cleaned up over the last number of years. And in fact, vehicles that are 2009 and newer are, you could say they're 20 or 50 times cleaner than cars from the 60s and 70s that are still on the road.
A retrofit question, and that's this does make a difference for diesel engines, and you can get particulate traps for diesel engines, and the state has done that on many of its school buses, so that is an important technology that you can access.
You're listening to Cleaning Up Utah's Air, a town hall meeting sponsored by the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. We're broadcasting live from the City Library in downtown Salt Lake City. Our panel includes Carrie Kelly with the Institute for Clean and Secure Energy at the University of Utah, Bryce Bird, Executive Director of the Utah Division of Air Quality, pulmonologist Dr. Denitsa Blagev with the Intermountain Medical Center, and Sean Tigan with Utah Foundation. a lot of health-related questions, Dr. Blagev. This is from Karen Concannon. Are yellow and orange days unsafe for outdoor exercise? And in a related question from Holly Molberg, what is the construction of an N95 mask that makes it capable of filtering out 95% of bacteria, viruses, dust, and 2.5 particles?
So in terms of is exercise unsafe outdoors on yellow and red days, I think most of us would recommend that if you're really anybody on definitely on red days, but even on yellow days, you should really try to limit exercising outdoors. So as Bryce mentioned, your exposure is much lower when you're indoors compared to outdoors, depending on assuming that there are not a lot of important indoor air pollutants. So if you live with a smoker who's smoking inside the house, perhaps you're not better off. But for most of us, when you exercise, you're taking in deeper breaths, you're working harder, you're, in a sense, getting more exposure to the air pollution. And so most people should not be exercising outdoors on red air days. And I think that actually creates a sort of paradox as we tell people on yellow and red days to stop driving, and then they say, well, should I be biking to work? And if you're my patient, I would say absolutely not. And I think one of the ways that people have tried to cope with that is with the N95s. I'm not sure I can speak to the technical details of their construction, but they are filters that are designed to filter out 95% of the particulates. It is important to recognize that none of the gas is filtered through the masks, and these masks usually have to be fitted, because if you don't have a good fit, then air can get in around the spaces and then you're breathing the particulates and the air pollution. So I think that answered those questions.
Okay. On Twitter, we've got a couple of questions from Communities for Clean Air, and this relates to many questions that we got on our email regarding industry. Why is Stericycle being rewarded for bad behavior? Stericycle, of course, the medical waste incinerator that is being allowed to move to Tooele. Another related question is, why is Holly Refinery burning off every night? Can you talk about the role the industry is playing in our pollution problem and state regulation of those industries? And Bryce, it's you again.
So I can talk about, in the state plan, we did identify some very costly controls. And one of the questions that often comes up is, why can't they be put in place today? And really the answer is an intuitive one, that these aren't off-the-shelf controls. These refineries, in some cases, were built in phases over the past 60 years, and so to say that you could just take a control and stick it on that refinery without engineering, without construction, without proper routing of all the equipment, of course, it does take time and it does take money. So the plans are that the limitations are in place now. They are required at this point, and they're required to be put into place as quickly as possible, but not today. As far as other companies, we do have I think this is an important distinction, that we do have an ongoing inspection program that we actively seek to find people who are violating our rules. The result of that was the Stericycle history over the past year. The reason this came to the forefront of public attention was our inspectors doing their jobs and finding issues with that facility. And as far as resolving that, unfortunately, and I'm not happy about this either, there is a process involved that takes time, that I don't have the ability to shut down a facility. I have the ability to issue a notice of violation. They have the ability to contest that, and then it can go through the court process ultimately to decide if it is a violation or not. That process is in place. As far as the refineries flaring, of course, flares at refineries are actually a required emissions control. Without the flares, the emissions would be much higher, and especially the ones that we're most concerned about, both the toxic air pollutants and these volatile organic compounds. So the flares are required in order to combust those rather than just letting them vent into the atmosphere.
Kara Kelly, I'm interested in your take on the whole regulation issue, and are we doing enough to tighten down on the industries that at least visibly we see polluting a lot?
Well, I'm going to add to what Bryce said about the refineries. So under the state implementation plan, they're requiring that all the refineries implement flare gas recovery. So that means instead of flaring for the majority of their gases, they are going to be recovering those. And there have also been millions and millions of dollars that are going to be required in investments by industry. Now, I know a number of people have asked about the increases and whether or not it's enough. I think that's a valid question, but they are certainly putting a lot of money behind improvements.
Sir, you've been very patient, yes.
Hi, I had a quick question about perception. And I lived in Houston for 10 years, and there's a lot of refineries in Houston, as you know. And they didn't seem to flare anywhere near as much as the Utah refineries. So my question is, why has Utah, if that perception is correct, why has Utah allowed the refineries not to update their equipment? And are the rules different in Utah than they are in Texas or California?
So maybe Carrie and I can team up on this one. So the reason that we're in our planning phase right now is there is a trigger to starting this process. Before EPA changed the standard for PM 2.5, we were in compliance with every EPA regulation that was in place. So for PM10, ozone, SO2, NOx, these are all standards that EPA has, but we were in compliance with each one of those standards. In 2006, the standard for fine particulate matter was revised in response to health studies that showed that it is, you know, really the particle that is of most concern and we need to address. That triggered this planning process, and under the Clean Air Act, that process, of course, needs to be in place within 10 years of that designation of non-attainment. And so this started the process, and that's when we started looking to other areas of the country, and that's when we looked for those controls, and flare gas recovery, which eliminates the flaring, was one of those controls.
And I also think that Houston is a good example because there are a couple things that happened in Houston. One is they took their time to understand the sources of pollution. They were actually about to require millions and millions of dollars in industry upgrades to reduce NOx emissions when it turned out that VOC emissions were really the rate-limiting pollutant. So again, I think it's really important that you understand the problem well before you start making your investments. And then the second issue is they work together with industry to implement the solutions. And I also think that that's really important because once they got industry on board and they realized that a lot of these fugitive emissions and their and the gases that they were flaring are recoverable products, it can make it a little bit easier to swallow.
In the balcony.
Yeah, my name is Kevin Slender. I'm a member of the Navajo Nation. I just had a question about you considered exemption for the indigenous population who has to use wood burning in their ceremonial rituals? And I just had that question of if you guys considered that exemption.
Wood burning, of course, according to your study, is a nice chunk of our pollution mix. And yet there are those who use it for ceremonial purposes, also those who have their sole source of heating as wood burning fireplaces or stoves. So Bryce, what do you do in those cases?
Well, the first, for the ceremonial purposes, that question has never been asked. And so I think that now that it has been asked, we can look at how we can accommodate that or address it. The other part of it is, you know, maybe look at the timing to make sure that it's not done when we have the inversions in place. If it could be put off a day or two, that could make all the difference. When we look at the sole source issue, that's something that we need to address. As was mentioned, that we are still finding smoke particles on our filter, even though we have had restrictions in place for a number of years. And so we still need to address that. And so we're working to do that. One of the things that we're doing is through a number of nonprofit organizations, including Breathe Utah, is looking to address that by funding or helping with the change out of these wood stoves. We're also, with this legislative session, Representative Arendt is looking at running legislation that would allow low-income people to get assistance in order to change this out. So it's something that, again, with better education and better understanding, we know it's something that we need to address right now, and we need to find mechanisms to facilitate that so it doesn't harm people.
Please. Okay. Down here, yes, sir. Okay.
Oh, either way. My name is Cynthia Nguyen, and I'm glad we're having this panel here to discuss some of the problems that we're seeing all over the valley. My question is a two-part question on two topics, that one of which we've touched on lightly, and the other one I don't think we've touched on at all, that I haven't seen a whole lot of research done on. The first question has to do with the geography of the Salt Lake Valley as contributing to the pollution within the valley here, because weather and air has a harder time traveling through the valley during the winter. And as a result, we've seen Salt Lake become the number one most polluted city in the country during winter time. But like you said, it does clear up quite a bit throughout the year, and as a result, our average lowers, but we really suffer a lot during the winter. And then my second question has to do with the contribution of ethanol in contributing to pollution, because it was proposed as an alternative in order to reduce emission problems. Ideas were proposed and research saying that alcohol substitutes, natural alcohol substitutes like ethanol, can help reduce pollution, but we're also seeing that ethanol being added to gasoline decreases the miles per gallon anywhere between 30 to 40% minimum. And so that kind of puts us at, essentially puts us in a circle where we think that we're reducing pollution, but we're gonna end up driving more as a result of having ethanol, using ethanol in gasoline, and also with the problems in manufacturing ethanol also contributes to pollution.
Let's take the second one first on ethanol, since it's fresh in our minds. Who wants to take that on? As far as, I mean, how much does it contribute to our, is it worse than regular gasoline? Is it, how does it compare to natural gas, electric?
So when the renewable fuel standard came into effect, actually our state was one of the states that came out in opposition to it. And it was on a number of grounds. First, our agricultural community was concerned about the increased cost of feed, because we're now competing with fuel to grow our food or feed ourselves. The second issue is with older cars. Actually, ethanol increases the emissions of these volatile organic compounds. It actually carries it through the rubber components of a vehicle. With cars that are built after about 2008, that's been addressed in the newer cars, but it does result in higher leak emissions from cars that are on the road. And as you mentioned, we're seeing more like a 2 to 3% fuel efficiency decrease, but it is an issue. We are burning more fuel because that product is in there. Anything
else? Okay, sir.
3 to 4.
Right here.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I want to follow up with this lady just said. Here's what I'm really concerned about, and as a context. Yeah, we got bad air days, but then we got bad air days during the summer. Yet I realized that there's 4 billion barrels of oil shale and tar sands about to be refined in the future to come into this valley. Our population is going to increase by doubling in 20 years unless we get off this dirty energy fossil fuels and start thinking more of alternative high mix fuels like alcohol, clean cars. We're not going to solve this problem.
Well, can
it's
I ask
going to get worse and worse.
Our panel, policy-wise, where are we? Are we pushing enough toward clean alternative fuels and transportation alternatives, I guess. Sean, what did you find in your study?
You know, I guess that we are at electric vehicles have been around for over 100 years. Even gas electric hybrids have been around for over 100 years. I mean, this technology has been here for a long time, but it does seem like we're turning the corner on this issue, where we're kind of focusing on, and these, you know, even electric vehicles, you may have zero emissions out of the tailpipe, but then there are emissions somewhere else and whatever. But hopefully you have the controls in place to reduce the emissions from power plants and from other places to the point where it makes sense to drive these electric vehicles. And the great thing about having an electric vehicle, if you're producing power somewhere else, or if you're producing power on your roof or from some wind turbine somewhere, is that you are not putting those particles into the air. The previous question talked about geography, and it's not the inversion that's the problem. It's the stuff that we're putting out of our tailpipes and out of our chimneys and out of these different places that is lingering around in with that inversion. That's the stuff that we breathe, that we're inhaling 3,000 gallons of air a day, and we're filtering through with a lot of that stuff. But I think that with Tier 3 improvements, and President Obama last night spoke about heavy duty trucks and increasing standards, fuel standards and whatnot on heavy duty trucks through executive action. It's those types of things that are hopefully going to increase at least our per vehicle mile traveled emissions. But as was brought up earlier, and what you mentioned, with an additional 1.6 million people along the Wasatch Front in the next 35 years or so, there is something is going to come to a head, and whether it is what Bryce spoke about earlier with kind of having centers where you're not driving 50 miles to work, but you're driving, maybe you've got some people living near Sandy and working in Sandy, and you've got some people living out in Eagle Mountain, and there's some business out there, and people live kind of where they're working, that with the constraints put on transportation corridors and whatnot, that may be the solution to kind of handle these issues. But it's all long-term stuff. Ultimately, it is these technological advances, but it's little things like wood burning, and it's not just the sole source of heat registry. Certainly not ceremonial fires, but it's people that go home and are just there to enjoy a fire for a couple hours or 1 hour, even on Christmas. It's Christmas, I'm going to have a fire. Maybe it's New Year's, or I'm going to have some people over, I'm going to have a fire for a couple hours. That is a huge, huge, disproportionately gigantic impact on the amount of emissions you're putting out in the air. You could send all of your family out in all the vehicles you have in the garage and on the street, and have them drive around for hours, and it's not as big of a deal as having a fire in your fireplace. And we talked about this having clean air inside the house earlier. I mean, having a fire in your house is, you're putting a lot of harmful stuff into the house. That nice homey smell that you harken back to when you were young, and it's a beautiful smell. You're putting that stuff in your house, but you're putting it in your neighbor's house, and it's those things. It does take a lot of technological advances, but it's people, I think, acting now to do the little things that they can do to quit, to reduce the emissions, their own personal emissions, as well as looking toward the government to make sure that they're doing the things that they can do to enforce the regulation on other emitters.
To the second part of the question, though, I mean, as the heavy industry expands, as the extraction industry expands, Bryce, I mean, how is that being figured into our air quality equation? Because obviously that's going to cause some pollution too.
And really, that's a difficult question for us as well. When we look at just our current condition, of course, we need to have reductions in order to keep it the way it is. And so, one of the things about the plan that is also not very well talked about is the fact that in the future there are really, really strict limitations on future growth. And in fact, because of an emissions offsetting program that's now in place, really it will take an existing company to reduce their emissions significantly to allow even one more large source into our area. So essentially, without that bank available, it is limited now within our non-attainment areas.
Yes, right in the back.
My name is Dean Dinas. I'm with Key Technologies here in Salt Lake City. Thank you very much for arranging this. This is tremendous. In conjunction with the development of the oil and gas industry in the Uinta Basin in particular, what kind of measures are being taken besides the ozone study out in the Uinta Basin to protect the oil and gas workers, the residents, and also the indigenous people, the tribes out there who are sitting on top of those lands? Can you give us, Bryce, an idea of what's planned and what's going on right now? Thank you.
Bryce?
Really, this is a problem that's not well understood yet. Really, we need to continue the research work, and that's ongoing right now. In fact, there's a study going on this minute out in the Uinta Basin. What we're seeing out there is the winter formation of ozone. And so if you're familiar with summertime smog, that's the major component is the ozone. What we're seeing is during stagnant conditions out in the Uinta Basin, this forming where it doesn't form really anywhere else that we're aware of other than these oil and gas fields. And so this winter, we required the companies to look for additional inspections, leak checking. Tomorrow we're going to be looking at a new general approval order for any new oil and gas operation in that area that will require flares, again, an emissions control device to control the leaks from those facilities. So the work is ongoing. As soon as we find things that are effective at reducing the emissions, we're putting those into place even as we're learning. But it is something that is still a tough puzzle to solve.
And Bryce, there are new oil and gas regulations that are coming into effect, right?
Correct.
Okay, right here.
Yeah, like back to the ceremonial practices, you know, like as a First Nations individual, we're the first ones exposed to this, and here you guys sit and talk about this, and we suffer the most than probably anyone in the nation. And God forgive us for all the churches we have open every day, let alone every Sunday. And I just want to know where or who can we speak to practice our spiritual practices. And especially when our people are the ones that are on the front lines of everything you talk about, they are giving their lives up for this cause that you guys are talking about. And we are asking for our spiritual practices for a Sunday.
Is there anyone who can shed some light on a contact person for this gentleman to be in touch with? We may have to get back to you on that one.
Would that be Joel?
Let's go in the very back, and then our time is running short. I really want to pack in our last 10 or 15 minutes on your ideas for solutions. What do you want to see done? What do you think is not being done quite yet? Let's go in the very back.
Hi, Frank Martin. My question is, how do you think this will affect tourism now and in the future?
You know,
Sean.
I think one of the reasons why this issue is really kind of, in my opinion, why it's kind of picking up steam right now. People talk about, you know, air pollution issues every year. And it does seem like last year the legislature started, you know, there was a flurry of bills during some bad air. But this year, the governor's really been talking a lot about it a lot more than in the past. And even the House Majority Leader has brought up the issue quite a bit. And before the legislative session started, you know, there were 15 bills, and there were likely to be quite a few more bills. And I think that one of the reasons why this is happening is because of things like tourism and economic development. And it's not necessarily tourism directly, but about the kind of the money. Like, we want jobs here, we want to have good businesses here, and we want to be able to bring in the talent to work in these great positions. And I think that might be one of the reasons why it's really getting the media attention it is, because a lot of people in power or whatever are talking about this stuff. And so more people are talking about it. And last year, you know, you get 40 people up to the Capitol and on a air quality protest, and this year you get 4,000, and I think it's because it has somewhat to do with the fact that people come here for Sundance, or they come here to ski, or they come here for Outdoor Retailers Association or whatever, and they see this and they think, you know what, this place is kind of cool, but this air is kind of horrible, and maybe that influences the decision for people to move here into the future. And I think, you know, ultimately, tourism, people are still going to come here and ski, because you're not in it when you're skiing, and people are going to come here for, you know, summer recreation activities, because you really don't see the ozone except in really in the valleys as much it's not as visual, and you don't taste it on your lips as much as you taste this winter inversion stuff. But so I think it affects it, but I think maybe more than that, that and the rest of it affects this economic development thing, which is maybe driving the reason why we're having this here, and there's been so much media attention about it this year.
This is an email from Steve Pastorino. He says, we're in the middle of relocating to California. surprisingly, over air quality, where no one believes the apocryphal stories I tell about how bad the air quality in Salt Lake has become. Let's go back here. Yes.
Can I just follow up on that?
Oh, yes, please. Dr. Blagev, and then we'll go to you.
I happened to move from San Francisco to Utah, and I think one of the, perhaps one of the reasons that people are really concerned about air quality here is that you do have these huge swings between good air and bad air, and I think in other places where you also may have problems with air pollution, you know, Los Angeles is not perfect, or neither is San Francisco, people might figure that that's just how bad my lung disease is, or that's just how I feel. Here, I think people have a really big difference in their health between good air days and bad air days, and I think it's much more visible to us.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, one statement, and then you ask for some suggestions. Please, if we can all leave today and tell your neighbors to contact their legislatures. My legislature said the most meaningful thing we can do is write letters or email or call. And please let them know that you want meaningful legislation, not just message bills, but meaningful legislation. And please talk to everyone to get in contact with their legislatures. The other thing is, I was wondering about anti-idling. I know the city has it, but the county or state doesn't. When I work in the school systems, and parents are idling for 15 minutes every day while picking up their kids. And can that be some type of meaningful legislation? Is that important? As well as updating the building codes. They're very old. They aren't efficient. What difference would that make?
Okay, let's hit idling first. How bad is idling? And what can we do to get people to stop?
You know, ultimately, it's all bad, and idling may not is certainly not a silver bullet. Like if we all go out and okay, I'm not going to idle, but I'm going to start my car at every 6 hours and run and do errands or something, or I'm going to drive around quite a bit, or I'm going to have a fire in my fireplace. But it is one thing. It's one measure, and I can't speak to you know what the percentage is that is going to bring down air pollution in the valley. It's hard to put real numbers on that, but it is something, and it particularly has an effect on area air pollution just outside the school where you've got a bunch of kids walking around and whatnot. So all of these measures, all of these little seemingly small and significant measures that we say, you know, it's just me idling my car, it's not a big deal. This is kind of the key. The key is to having a collective action where we're all taking steps to get a handle on this issue.
Well, this is a follow-up from Paul Browning. Since idling of cars wastes fuel and adds to the pollution levels, how about a restriction on at least red air days? Do you see any movement on the Hill, Sean, that maybe somebody is going to introduce a bill, perhaps?
So I haven't seen a bill this legislative session on that, and I haven't heard any specific talk about that. But.
And this gentleman says, if you count the number of fast food restaurants, coffee shops, banks, and pharmacies, this restriction could be significant. Let's go in the back.
And I guess I did want to mention one thing about idling. Carrie. The reason it's important not to idle is because you don't have much, you don't have the optimum flow coming out of your vehicle, and it's at a lower temperature, so your whole emission control system is not operating properly. So whatever you can do to avoid idling is good.
Yes.
This is kind of a perhaps a little extreme solution, but it did work in Mexico City and in several other cities around the world, and that's to restrict driving on days according to the final digit or letter on your license plate. And although I think there could be a lot of backlash if we tried to regulate that, I do feel that human beings are highly adaptable. And if that regulation was put into place, people would find another way on the one day or 2 days a week that they weren't permitted to drive their car. And if that was the regulation that was enforced on everyone, instead of one person just on their own saying, you know, oh man, okay, I'm gonna try to do the right thing and not drive, well then you feel bad or like a victim or whatever. But if everybody has to do it, then that victim mentality goes away, and I think it could make a great deal of difference. Mm. And the other point I wanted to make is I heard Brian Munch say something somewhere along the way about do we want to be a Pittsburgh or a Palo Alto? And that really resonated for me because I feel that with our stunning natural beauty that we could be very, very attractive to clean technology. And what is the possibility of phasing out the dirty energy and the pollutants that we have in this closed valley, which is insane that we have these companies in a closed valley. and couldn't we then, you know, try to stimulate our economy through clean technology? Thank you.
To answer the first question,
Bryce, yes.
As part of our state plan, we actually had a stakeholder process, and I'm so encouraged to see this many people here. When we started that process, we found 100 people that were willing to participate with us, only 100. We would have loved to have had this group here tonight or 3,000 to 4,000. But one of the strategies that came out was the either odd, even drive days, so every other day. And as we looked at other areas that had tried that, Chicago, Atlanta, and Mexico City, as you mentioned, the adaptation, unfortunately, the adaptation is you buy a second car or you drive a much dirtier car than you would have. So instead of leaving the old pickup truck parked in your driveway, you then park your Prius and drive the other car. So in those cities that tried it, it actually hasn't been as effective as they'd hoped.
Mm. Yes, sir.
John Bennion. You haven't talked much about the ill effects of ozone compared to particulates. Could you say a few words about that, the relative harm done ozone particulates, and are the strategies for combating bad ozone days about the same generally as the strategies for inversion during winter days?
Dr. Blagov, do you want to take the first part of that?
Yeah, I think ozone is one of the gases that is associated with the ill effects, and I think more of the, I think there's been more research with the particulates compared to ozone, but certainly people have increased risk of asthma exacerbations and developing asthma. The strategies for avoiding it would be similar in terms of if it's outdoor ozone, because there are indoor sources of ozone, but if it's outdoor ozone air pollution like we would typically have in the summer during summer days or now in the winter in the Uinta Basin, then staying indoors would be a better way of protecting yourself.
But as far as controls, actually the same strategies that we're developing for winter particulate will also be effective for ozone in the summer. So VOCs and NOx are the key components to the ozone formation as well.
Right in the back.
Yeah, hi, Leo Coombs. So just maybe 2 points. The first thing was maybe more of a question, and that is, has the state of Utah given any consideration into implementing more sort of smart lights around intersections to keep a more constant flow of traffic? I've been sort of doing time studies, you know, for the last couple of years on my traffic pattern, and I actually have been able to reduce my idle time by about a minute per day. And that actually, if you do the math for the million or so vehicles in the state of Utah, amounts to right around, and you'll have to forgive me, I got to look at my notes here, but it was, based on the numbers I've got, it's about a 9% reduction in the amount of emissions from vehicles. So, you know, that's sort of an idea I throw out there for people to consider in shutting down vehicles. But I guess more importantly is it would be interesting to put more smart lights in areas where, you know, because we all know we do it, there's 10 vehicles that are sitting there waiting for no traffic on the other side of the coin. And so
we don't have a lot of city planners or urban developer types on our panel, but maybe you can just talk broadly about technology, emerging technology, and ways that we can get around more efficiently.
So one issue with that, when I learned how much a smart intersection costs, the street light, it's about $100,000 per intersection. And that just made me really, really jealous, because that's about what our air monitoring stations cost. And we have 22 in the entire country, so look at every intersection and think that that could be an air monitoring station if we could just figure out how to drive less and drive smarter. But as part of that effort, UDOT, at least on their thoroughfares that they control, have a $5 million budget to go through and retime those on a five-year basis. It's clearly not enough. And of course, whenever I drive, I'm always somehow not going the direction that it was timed to go. And I think that is a frustration for all of us.
We've all been there, Bryce. It's okay. You have one there? Yes.
Hi, I'm Jerome Soler, president of the Cognitech, a small software company. About a year ago, we put in a recommendation to the governor's office that they should put in place standards that would increase the amount of telecommuting that State of Utah employees do, because we actually work with the state. We're a state contractor for the Department of Health. And the state has the control over their own employees and contractors, as well as can work with large employers like Hill Air Force Base to mandate that non-necessary people are required to telecommute, particularly on bad air days. What are your thoughts on that, and what has been done up to this point to increase the amount of telecommuting?
Sean?
You know, I guess you're talking about the state, but there are some groups like the Salt Lake Chamber is working on this issue a lot with their members and trying to encourage their members to kind of get behind this idea. And they're, and to get back to this question earlier about tourism and economic development stuff that we talked about, I think that is definitely a big option. But as I said earlier, you know, those to and from work trips, they only, I mean, it all helps, but they only make up about 20% of the trips we make. I mean, if we can cut out some of those non-mandatory trips, that's a lot easier, and we can do that tomorrow. We don't have to wait until, you know, the state does something or until the company we work for does something. We can do it, you know, we can make up our own minds and do it tomorrow. And you know, without a stick, you know, it's hard to get people to often kind of follow those words of advice and to reduce air pollution. But I think that, you know, the idea of telecommuting, it's a big deal. Just like a lot of these things are a big deal. And I don't know if anybody else has anything.
Well,
else to add
there. I will add that a number of large state organizations are developing plans to reduce their contribution to poor air quality, including the University of Utah, and that is a strategy that's being considered. I don't know where it'll eventually line up in terms of the priority, but it is being considered.
Just one thing to add also, there's a toolkit available through the TravelWise program. So it's a UDOT program. It's just travelwise.utah.gov. There's a toolkit for communities. There's a toolkit for business, and it really does focus on alternate ways to get your people to work, alternate ways to get the work done, and again, it's a great resource if you're looking for information on that.
We've only got time for a couple more questions, right here, and then over here.
I used to live in Oregon, and I have a bunch of friends who live up in Seattle, and their population distribution and their situation is really similar to what we have here. I think 80% of the people in Oregon live in the Willamette Valley, and a pretty equivalent percentage of people in Washington live along the Puget Sound. Both are encapsulated by mountains. And one thing they're doing is they're putting electric vehicle recharge stations next to the freeway entrances along the I-5 corridor, which covers, you know, I think several tens of millions of people almost. And that's actually had a pretty huge impact on the number of people who actually buy electric vehicles. If you drive around Seattle, you'll actually see Teslas and Nissan Leafs and stuff, and that's something see in Salt Lake. Well, we were just talking about recommendations, so I was wondering if that's something we could possibly implement here, since such a large percentage of our population lives along the I-15 corridor.
You know, I think we'll see a lot more of that in the near term because of some changes to state rules that allow you to resell electricity, and there's a bill going through the legislature this year as well that'll kind of address that issue. But it does seem that particularly if you're able to resell it, if you're able to charge something for that electricity so people can plug in their cars and fill those things up for a charge on the way home or whatever, I believe that over the next, you know, 1 or 2 years, that's going to be something that becomes quite a bit more ubiquitous than it is today.
And yes, final question.
Very interested in the idea that the population is going to increase and we're still going to be trying to meet some sort of an air standard. And I just kind of thought, what if we did a great job and we cleaned it up completely? You realize the population would probably increase a factor of 10 because it's so beautiful to live here. So have you been thinking about what this long term is really going to look like in this valley? And are we prepared to make the changes so that we could quadruple 10 times the population and still have beautiful air? I'd like maybe some sort of an idea of where we might be going in the state.
I guess I'd like to take a little bit of a stab at that. And first of all, I think a lot of the strategies we've talked about are kind of near-term strategies. addressing wood smoke, tier three vehicle standards. But as population continues to grow, we need to get smarter. So we need to look at renewables, we need to look at zero emission vehicles, better transportation, better building codes, all these things. I mean, air quality is gonna remain a challenge in a valley like this, so we're just gonna have to keep getting better. Other thoughts?
Again, I mentioned the opportunity earlier, but with the next planning cycle that Envision Utah is starting right now, be involved in that. Let them know what your goals are for your future, and that will drive what comes out of that process. I think the last visioning process was very successful. Maybe that it didn't address everything, but we're in a better situation now than we would have been without it. And I think this is a great opportunity with this next planning effort to get those issues brought to the forefront.
We had a lot of really interesting ideas come online. Wally Kallstrom wants a $2,000 tax credit to convert all cars in Utah to natural gas. Kathy Alsbury wants to reduce the speed limit to 55. Outdoor Gal wants air regulations on how low airplanes can fly, because she does not think that planes flying low is good for our air quality. I guess my final question to all of you is, if you had unilateral control, what three things would you want to institute today to improve our air? Bryce, I'll start with you.
And I can, since it was brought up, actually we can already solve one of those, and that is there's already a $2,500 tax credit available today to convert fuels to natural gas, and so vehicles to natural gas. So that's already in place right now. It's being reauthorized this legislative session, so that's one good thing. Really, as I look at, if I had my wand, I think it would be 1,000 things, and that's unfortunately...
Three, Bryce,
I
three.
Know. But that's what I've learned, is there are no silver bullets. There is not one thing that we could do to solve our problem. It really is nibbles at the apple, and with enough nibbles, we'll get there. I think that the planning effort that we did was a good start, it's a foundation, but it's not the end. And so my one thing is to everyone, jump on now, use the tools that are available, make that one change in your life that then is an example to others.
Dr. Blagev?
So, I mean, thinking about what three things would be most useful, I guess I'm going to rely on my colleagues and say that, trying to limit driving, which unfortunately in the current infrastructure is really difficult, and so I think much better public transportation where it makes it feasible and reasonable for people to use public transportation rather than just relying... than just relying on people that are extraordinarily committed and willing to sacrifice a lot in order to make the air a little bit cleaner. The second would be, trying to be smarter about heating our homes and, with obvious exceptions about religious practices, but just the wood burning. It seems like we can't really justify living here and having wood burning fireplaces or heating our homes with wood. And I think industrial emissions would be the other one.
Sean Tagan.
I think that one of the top ones would be giving the Division of Air Quality the resources they would like in order to do kind of the enforcement and the compliance measures that they would like to enforce. But I also like the tax credit idea. I like an idea of maybe like a $250 tax credit for bicycles. But also, ultimately, it's like if I had my magic wand, I would tap us all on the head and get us to do those small measures that really make a big difference. And that's stuff like turning down your thermostat and not driving as much and all that kind of stuff. So.
And Carrie Kelly.
So I would say first, zero emission transportation, whether or not that's riding your bike or electric vehicles or mass transportation. So that's one. The second one would be a near-term strategy that's been talked about a lot, and that's tier three vehicles and fuel. And I guess I should say one thing about CNG. So the data is showing that the new tier three vehicles are about the same as compressed natural gas vehicles. So that's something to think about for the future. And then finally, giving DAQ the resources they need for research to make sure we understand this problem well, that we continue to identify the sources that are going to be the most fruitful, and that they can enforce regulations that are already in place.
All right, I'd like to thank our panelists very much. Carrie Kelly with the Institute for Clean and Secure Energy at the University of Utah, Sean Tigan with Utah Foundation, pulmonologist Dr. Denitsa Blagev with Intermountain Medical Center, and Bryce Bird, Executive Director of the Utah Division of Air Quality. Please join me in thanking them tonight. Thanks also to KCPW Public Radio for broadcasting this forum, to the City Library for their terrific help, and thanks to you for your exceptional questions and for caring to show up. KUED Channel 7 is producing a documentary, The Air We Breathe. It's set to air on February 5th at 7 p.m. Our own Tribune reporter, Brian Maffley, will appear in a discussion aired after that documentary. And for much more information, full coverage of air quality issues, go to our website, sltrib.com. For the Salt Lake Tribune, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Thank you, and good night.